You're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick in the UK. This is part two of episode 17, where we talk about gender in organizations with our dear guest, Dr. Deborah Brewis. To find out more about the episode and to listen to the insightful conversation in part one, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. And now, back to the conversation. The boundary heightening is a fascinating part of the paper because it really talks about this exaggeration of the dominance culture in ways that heighten the boundaries, even when there are these overt statements on the dominance part about trying to be more inclusive. And it basically causes these heightenings of difference through interruptions and overt inhibitions when people say, oh, I was going to tell this joke, but I can't because, you know, Jane is here as a result. So basically singles her as the reason for the change in behavior. And then this, what I thought was interesting about that, this inhibition, is that it actually leads to further isolation. And then there, you get into this, another part of the boundary heightening of these loyalty tests, which I think we can talk about quite a bit, about how the tokens function through these loyalty tests. So, Pedro, I know you had some observations you wanted to make here.
Yeah, because this, in a way, brings me back to the discussion about assimilation, you know, to the extent that women are required to take on the position of the dominant in a way and just ignore, in a way, the others from the same category, or they're able to remain in the position of woman, to a way. And this, I mean, after Cantor, there has been much discussions about gender and gender equality and different ways to promote it. And what's happened in decades after that was people started to actually question the idea that necessarily women would, in a way, disrupt traditional workplaces. And many people started to say that actually, no, they would bring something new and almost like creating a new role in a very savior-like way. And there is this famous piece called The Way Women Lead that appeared in HBR decades ago. And it, in a way, it glorifies traits that are perceived to be characteristics of women, such as being more nurturing or collaborative. So there was this idea that women would join the workplace and they would improve it because they would bring new values, which in a way I find as complex and as problematic, because it's, again, it's an assimilation that doesn't unpack the mechanism in the first place, in a way.
Yeah, I agree with that, because it is this difficult struggle, push-pull maybe, over this, the idea that women, or the tokens in Cantor's language, bring diversity and sort of different ways of thinking that ought to be embraced more. And yet there's situations where the culture or the performance of the dominance may be a key success factor in how they function, and therefore they're resistant to making those kinds of changes. And I think if you take the simplistic view that, and I'm not saying you did, but this like you said, there's this extra complexity to these ideas that the workplace should value the changes that tokens bring. I wonder if there isn't also some tendency, though, from the dominance to lose respect for tokens who don't fit in the dominant mode or don't do things the way that they would expect. So sure, they bring these different kinds of characteristics, but the dominants don't tend to value them.
Yeah, so I think I'm going to try to say what I said before in a more clear-cut ways, is that all this pressure, as you said, you know, this what Cantor calls loyalty tests, you know, when women are expected to take the position of men. So pretty much they're saying that in order to succeed here, you have to be a man, to behave like one, to be one of the boys, as she puts it. And I was saying that, yes, that's a problem. But also what happened in the decades after what she wrote was that people started to position that a different alternative would be to be a woman. And there was specific, I would say, expectations what being a woman and bringing these values would entail. So it's funny. It's almost feel that women have the choice of being a man or being a woman, but never being an individual. To go back to what Deborah was saying.
That's a great point, because it devolves into stereotypes either way you go.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Pedro brings up a really good point here about the danger of reifying either what women are or what men are. And it speaks to some of the conversations that we're having in public now, or that, you know, we have been having as academics for a while now, and as activists have as well, about the non-binary views of gender and slightly more fluid views of gender that we might have, as opposed to looking at gender in terms of binary categories. And so when I was reading this text, I was thinking, you know, how might we use this text now in light of new ways of thinking about gender, and also ways of thinking about gender in which gender becomes detached from the biological body, if you see what I mean, from a male body or a female body, and also considering bodies that fall somewhere in between. So there are certainly discussions that we've been having recently that complicate the really rather tidy framework that Cantor lays out.
Yeah. If I understand it correctly, I think you are bringing the issue of intersectionality here, which is, I would say, like a more new discussion after Cantor, which is exactly that there is not such a thing as a woman. You know, as you were saying, there are different kinds of bodies, there are different kinds of categories that intersect. So this assumption that, I mean, in a way, I can understand that back then, I think the salient difference might have been the gender entered the workplace more than race or sexuality or anything. But I think that by now, at least on research, we know that it is there are different ways to be woman in a way, you know, which she was not really considering back
then. Well, and I think what both you were talking about is this very interesting idea of the hard categories, the binary-like categories, and then if you bring in people who are transgendered or that kind of aspect of it, now you're having more categories, and that's just difficult for people to process, where it doesn't match their categories of what they would expect. And so there's a lot of initial resistance to those kinds of things. So whether it's society-wide about who uses what kind of bathroom, or how you accommodate people in the workplace, those are very difficult issues.
I'd just like to pick up on this concept of intersectionality that Pedro was talking about, because it also, I mean, speaks to the idea that Or the concept of master status that Cantor has in this piece, and that master status, as we were talking about, can dominate over, you know, other more individualized features like performance or things like that, competence, things like that. That, you know, what happens when you have double the markers of difference, or triple, you know, if you're a black woman in a predominantly white male group, or what happens if you're a disabled gay man in a predominantly able-bodied straight group. So how these affect interactions when you're the token in more than one way, you know, which status takes over?
Well, and I agree with you, Deborah, because we see this very strong kind of category-based way that Cantor is initially looking at it. And then I think what you're emphasizing is, hey, there's a lot more nuance here, and a lot of other things that, if you know, people who think, well, we're over gender this or we're over integration that. Now, there's many interesting things to research and study because the effects are real.
Yeah. I think I want to complicate a bit.
I like it when you do that. Andrew, complicate things.
I want to play devil's advocate. No, I want to play devil's advocate almost, you know, because I'll be curious to know what research shows, but I tend to think that although, yes, we are all a plurality, and it's hard to think of someone, I mean, and as I said, there is many, many cases that we can think about of someone having two, I would say, intersecting categories and so on and so forth, but I suspect that depending on the group that you are, people read you for one category. At least that's my experience. You know, you can be read by your belonging to a sexual minority or being a foreigner or being of a specific race. But I usually think that depending on, at least for me, different groups I think I'll join, people tend to read me based on one specific thing that they take to be more salient, at least. And I think I do that as well. But
yeah, I mean, I don't know. I agree with that. I think that probably is the case, but it's, you know, what are the factors that come into play in deciding which of those differences become salient? And I think investigating those things will be very telling about our current social contexts. I just, if you'll permit me, want to go back to that point that Pedro was talking about when we were talking about intersectionality, because I think along with the fact that it may well be that one status dominates over another in certain cases, I think it is important for us to recognise that there are intersections which are salient. So, for example, if we take Black women, you know, Black women's experience, it may be in particular situations that white women are permitted to behave in particular ways and take on particular roles, but Black women aren't. So there is something particular about when certain intersections come into play.
And I think this, in a way, starts to pose a challenge, at least to counters thinking, because it's very much about numbers when you know that status and relations and interactions are about power.
Yeah, I think that's a great point.
So what, you know, and it's the very, I think she used the terms dominant, and but you know, the dominance is not one that is about, you know, numbers, but it's one about, I mean, power. It's in there. It's already in the word she uses, but she doesn't tease apart.
Yeah, so let me
so
give
much.
You an example. When I was that I think illustrates what you're talking about. So when I was in the federally employed women, that's the group. It's called FEW. Group where there were, I was the token. There was only a couple of the males in there. I was cognizant of the fact, however, that I came into that group not as a necessarily as a peer, and I don't mean it from a gender point of view, but I was the commanding officer of the facility, so that power was, you know, came with me into the room, and certainly affected the interaction. So it wasn't purely good. I think it goes back to this, what you're talking about, Pedro, that it's not, if I'm understanding it correctly, it's not purely the numbers, because power has quite a bit to do with it, even in circumstances where you might be the token.
Exactly. And I think it brings us more to the context in what Deb was talking about, you know. It's the whole thing being when race intersects gender and so on and so forth, that creates specific expectations. That's not only about the number, but what we expect a Black person or a Black woman to do, to be, to behave like.
Oh, I was just going to mention that in Cantor's book, Men and Women of the Corporation, she has one part called Structure and Processes, which is where this text is taken from. Or, you know, is derived from. And the other two sections in that part are called Opportunity and Power. So there are, she does get round at some, you know, to talking about how opportunity accumulates and reinforces the inequality of the status quo and how power does. But you're right that it is kind of siphoned off from this text.
Well, that was a great comment. And I think one of the things that Deborah is pointing out is that we have to be careful when we read these texts to place them in context. I think that was very helpful to help us see that this wasn't the only thing she was writing about, and these other parts do come in, but you do have to compartmentalize it a bit for publishing and to make it something you can have in a journal. But I was just thinking when both of you were describing the, you know, a case where a Black woman from the South or a Black woman from the Northeast, or you think about when do these particular characteristics of intersectionality become salient, I was thinking, so on one level I was thinking, oh, it's hard to know, you know, how to behave or act or respond, you know, given all these complexities, which as a social scientist I value. And then I was just thinking, isn't it interesting how people struggle to treat other people as individuals, where we there's sort of this kind of default mode in the categories, right? As opposed to saying, I'll just react to Pedro as an individual. And that's the kind of Pedro I'm going to respond to, as opposed to whatever particular group, you know, Pedro responds or, you know, says he's a member of, that I'll derive my behavior with Pedro from what his behavior is, what I see in him, as opposed to all these lenses and categories I have to fit him in. That apparently it's not easy for people.
And I think that ties in with a thought I had earlier when we were talking about visibility. Cantor mentions in her text that the visibility of particular differences is relevant in terms of whether they become a factor in marking you out as a token or not. And it got me thinking about the digital sphere and how we interact online and kind of the promise of the digital sphere, that it sort of is meant to or is sometimes thought to level these kind of differences. But I mean, increasingly evidence seems to show that it doesn't entirely. And a piece of work that has been done on female entrepreneurs that argues that they face really the same types of disadvantages that they do in the non-digital world. And I was also thinking about, you know, social media and how this relates to what Cantor was talking about, women and the reluctance to be so visible. And I was thinking about, you know, recent things that have happened on Twitter where certain people have spoken out and received a lot of backlash from it. And so visibility online also opens you up to, it gives you a, it also opens you up to a certain amount of hate.
This is actually very interesting, because when you mentioned visibility and online, I thought of not the problems, but actually the benefits, because I don't know much, but I read some papers about people that were studying, I don't know if they were online forums or just email lists, and the whole thing went, you know, people started to communicate more and digitally, you know, and they found out that actually, I think there was this Liz Prow was the name of the woman actually that was doing this this research, and what she found out, it was about, I think, the introduction of maybe emails or email lists in an academic department. And she found out that people were, in a way, less respectful of hierarchies and boundaries as they would be in a normal meeting. So people would email superiors much more and contesting superiors much more than they would be if they were all physically present in a meeting. So in a way, I think one of the discoveries was that actually interacting with someone via email in a way reduces the differences or power differences that exist, because of course it's much more direct. You can send an email to a manager or supervisor and don't have to be, you know, like speaking out in the middle of a room. But anyway, what you brought out is actually the other side of the coin, if you will, in which people sometimes, you know, it's the whole thing about anonymity that exists online, that people feel authorized to be as, I would say, vicious as possible. You know, that
right, they're harsh.
Harsh, right? Yes, harsh, yeah. Exactly. You know, I don't know if you know, but there is this whole discussion on gay-related apps for interacting, meeting people and hookups and everything, like Grindr, so on and so forth, that there are a lot of discussions within the gay community and outside that many people write on their profiles things like no Asians or no effeminates or no this or no that or no blacks, you know, specifically, which would be very odd.
Really?
Yes. And
really?
I mean, I would never imagine someone going to a bar and say like, no, please don't talk to me, you're Asian. But people feel authorized to do that in a profile online, you know.
Goodness.
Yeah. So I think it goes both ways. I got Ralph shocked.
Well, not so much shocked. So it wasn't about the gay apps. Mm-hmm. It was this idea that people would have no problem coming out and saying, you know, whether you're gay or straight, and saying no Asians, right? Or yes. No, you know, no women or so. You know, I don't really know, but you just so yeah. I just didn't occur to me, because one of the things I find interesting about that is what it says about the person. Right, who makes strong statements like that, and the fact that they feel free to do it. Oh yeah, this is pretty amazing. I just didn't realize that.
And I think it goes exactly on the issue that we're just talking about. It's not only about numerical issues, but there is the power there, because it's not much how many, I think, women would be in a forum or on Twitter or present online, but it's exactly what the roles, expectations, who can talk about what to whom, and all this kind of, you know,
yes,
inequality, yes, that exists in the way we go about our lives, you know, and what we...
Right, and I think that's what Deborah was talking about, was that mm-hmm. there, that some of these things carry over into social media. So it's a very complex understanding. I thought that study on women entrepreneurs was very interesting that Deborah was talking about.
The author I know on that is Angela D. at Loughborough London, and that was a human relations paper this year. So it's worth taking a look at.
We've alluded to it briefly. So there's this idea about the exaggeration of the dominance culture, where people will tell off-color jokes or do things that they know are not supposed to be done around the tokens, or maybe not know as a way to do it, but they accentuate those things as a way of isolating them. And then you have interruptions that are the reminders of a difference, where somebody will overtly be telling a story or doing something and then say, oh, you know, I can't do this because Ralph's here. And then basically singles me out as a token. And then there's these inhibitions of informal behavior, like not inviting the tokens out to drinks afterwards, where lots of the business gets done and these relationships get built or the mentoring occurs. Cantor talks a lot about that, about these informal relationships that are often isolating for the tokens. And then I think we had, all of us had talked a little bit about these loyalty tests that the tokens got, you know, get subjected to as to prove that they're, you know, they're basically not part of their original group, or that you know, that they're shedding their difference to just assimilate. And both of you had talked about assimilation. One thing that so this made me think about, and I think this can pass the podcast censors. So in the United States, this is probably two decades ago, this is a pretty old debate. There was this time when women sports reporters were tokens in the field, and they're probably still very small numbers. I'm not sure exactly. And there was this common practice, and I would imagine it occurred in Europe as well, where reporters would be allowed into the changing rooms, what we call them, the locker rooms, where people were showering and dressing and that sort of thing after the game. And the reporters would follow them in to get stories and reactions to the game, you know, those kinds of things. And you still see that much of that on American television, but it's always from like the neck or way, you know, waist up, but sometimes the men are shirtless. And there was this big controversy over allowing women reporters into the locker rooms, because essentially what we were doing, and this is probably around the time Cantor is writing about this, is they were being excluded from some of the best opportunities to gain, you know, information and things that they could use in their stories. And that became this whole big controversy of, oh, the women are being pushy, or they're not. And yet, if you look at it through the framework that Cantor puts in place, you realize, well, they were being excluded. I mean, they weren't going to be able to develop further in their profession because this source of very useful data was off limits to them. And so there were some people that were pushing pretty hard for that. So I just thought that was interesting when you look at these, you know, kind of heightening of the boundaries. That's what it made me think of.
I had something, I think that's really interesting. I had something to add around this idea of boundary heightening. Cantor makes a comment on, it's page 975, and it's actually in a footnote. And she talks about how the entrance of an outsider can be perceived to cause extra work, essentially, for the people who are already there.
Yeah.
You know, it's extra work to be truly inclusive of somebody who's different in some way. And I was thinking to the research that I've done recently on diversity practice, and the way that, certainly in my research, that I found that it's being reframed in current thinking is that rather than being extra work, this is a professional competency, you know, it's skill of the modern workplace, and is being kind of promoted in that way. You know, being inclusive is part of properly being a professional now. So that was an interesting kind of reflection back to that. And that it was hidden away in a footnote there. I thought it was one of the most interesting things about the paper.
That's actually very interesting. I think it goes back to the whole thing that, you know, thinking beyond numbers and power, and also what we said in the first section on Ralph was talking about his episode and his experience, you know, in a way being an ally for gender equality, which is exactly the role of the dominance in these processes. And it's interesting that, you know, it seems that the tide has changed from what you're talking about, that it's considered almost like part of the job description.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly been reframed that way, that it's a baseline now. It's not extra, it's the least we need to do.
Okay. And so, and that tips point, I'll put my queer hat on and think those terms in similar but different issues, is that I would be interested to know from your research what you found out, what does being inclusive mean? Because, as you know, nowadays, I think being gay or queer in general, LGBTQ+, is accepted in certain places, in certain, I would say, work environments, especially if you think about typical white-collar, techie, or upper-class, famous in like companies, I don't know, Google, Microsoft, you know, they all have alliances for gays and blah, 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 and I know they put their ads on gay prides. You know, there is all this idea that, you know, the corporations took a stance for equal love and everything and so on and so forth. So I think everyone would say that they want people to respect that at the workplace. But what I usually find, at least in the advertising that they put forward, is that they are endorsing a specific kind of, say, behaviors tied to, I would say, LGBTQ+ people. You know, it's always about, it's this very mirroring straight-like word in which it's all about equal love and respecting your partners and, you know, all this kind
so
of
like a
very...
straight translation? Is that what you mean? Like a straight translation of those things?
Exactly. No, you've always when you see, like, they're talking about that, they say about, you know, forming families and getting married and, you know, being in a very, you know, appropriate, you know,
yes, or traditional
traditional
sense,
right? Yes, and I think that that's something that has been discussed in the Black movement as well, which is this idea of respectability, you know, being a Black person of a certain way that doesn't talk loud, that doesn't, you know, tries to correspond as much as it can to what is perceived to be the traits of the dominant in a way. So what I found is that exactly, no, sometimes being inclusive means being inclusive of specific things. You know? So I'd be curious to know on the gender perspective what you found out.
Not
that.
From my research and, sorry, not talking to gender, but there's a really nice paper by Elaine Swan where she talks about the image of the mosaic that is often used to represent diversity. And she talks about how that mosaic presents a very contained, safe view of ethnic diversity. So that's worth having a look at if any of the listeners are interested in this particular point, that you know, differences are made safe for us in particular ways, and that, with air quotes, dangerous differences are still not included. There's a particular range of difference that we're willing to include,
right? Or that the dominant set what the range of differences are acceptable, right? That's, I think that's part of what Pedro was talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Just one thing about this section, about boundary heightening, that Cantor talks about the very end. It's about humor and how one of the ways that, you know, this difference gets reinforced is by the way the kind of, you know, jokes that, in this case, the men tell about women and how they might find themselves having to accept and laugh these kind of jokes in order
to be accepted
in that environment.
And particularly, and they were like pretty strong negative stereotypical jokes kind of stuff. That struck me as painful to read about, to think that people would be under that kind of pressure. But that's a very good point, where humor is almost used as a negative way.
I think this opens up the issue whether humor is political. And at least now in Brazil, there is a lot of discussion that, you know, many comedians and stand-up comedians have complained that people would find their jokes offensive, and they usually say, oh, you cannot make a joke anymore, and blah, blah, blah. And recently, just a few days ago, because we're going to have, you know, elections for, not the president, but the more local offices, there was this guy that put on a meme, and I think there is like a little girl in front of a burnt house, and a house on fire. And he wrote on his, I don't know, advertising marketing materials that was something along the lines of, this is what's going to happen to the feminists if I win the election, you know? And wow. It was a very strong thing. And of course, as you can imagine, like the, all the, I mean, he got, I think, removed to run for the election and he's going to have to respond for, you know, I don't know how to classify in legal terms, but in a way, like invitations for violence against women, so on and so forth. But he replied that, you know, oh, no, nowadays you cannot even make a joke. And that was even a joke. People lost their sense of humor. And that's exactly the thing that we are still, in a way, debating.
Yes.
Related to this, Sarah Ahmed has had some nice discussions about the concept of the killjoy and how people who are sort of refuse to join in the humor and who kind of stand against and are often cast as, yeah, as the killjoy and as sort of removing all the pleasure from life, taking things too seriously. And she actually proposes, in a feminist sense, that we reclaim the idea of the killjoy, that the killjoy is something positive that you can be, and kind of casts it as a political stance, which is a really interesting way of kind of trying to turn it on its head.
Well, that's an interesting point, because we have something similar to what Pedro was talking about here in the United States, where there's some heightened sensitivity in college campuses to people being exposed to views that are going to hurt their feelings or be damaging to them in some way, or something that they would find difficult to process. And you got this one camp that says, you know, you should just toughen up and be open to anything. And then you have this other camp that says, well, you can't even go to college campuses. We have comedians that complain about this. They say they won't even go to college campuses to do their routines because people are so sensitive. And I wonder, when Deborah talks about this killjoy thing, well, maybe it's not such a bad thing that we people should be inhibited from making jokes at others' expense, right? Where you have to offend somebody to be humorous, or that's considered a form of humor. I think that's really interesting, this idea that we should, that Deborah's point, I believe, was there's the author that she was discussing has mentioned that a killjoy, actually there's positive benefits to that. And I will tell you from my own experience. So when I was at the Naval Academy, we were the third Naval Academy class to have women. Up until that time, all the service academies had been only male. And militaries had made these a lot of separate but equal arguments, and all of that was dismissed. So 1980 they came, and 1982 my class had about 100 women. So very, very token-ish, because I think our total class was 1,400 or 1,300 students, and about 120 of them were women. So, you know, 90-10 kind of ratio. And there were all these things that were now off limits, you know, that you couldn't do, you know, because of course the military often takes these things as just a list of do's and don'ts. But we were still talking about this learning about women. Women were new, but many, many cases it was stereotypical. But one of the things I thought about, to go back to this killjoy thing, is I thought, you know, a lot of that stuff that I see these lists that you can't do anymore, that's just dumb stuff. You know, I don't think I'm missing anything. And in fact, I think it's good that the presence of women is making us more aware of this dumb stuff that we shouldn't be doing anymore. And so I actually thought that aspect of their inclusion was a great thing.
Well, I think that we, in a way, we are, comparing to what Cantor was writing, we are more in a tipping point in which we have, I mean, people, it's accepted that you can be against those kind of humor. Now, there is a consequence if you make a joke like that. In the case of these politicians in Brazil, you know, he won't be able to run for the election, you know. So I think the thing has to change that way, that at least you can, there is legitimacy in fighting back and not, you know, killing the joy, as to use the concept. Yeah.
Well, and you're not ostracized. I think that's what you're saying, right? Is that so? Mm-hmm. If you're doing this bad behavior, ostracized. You're not ostracized for being the killjoy. When in Cantor's time, you probably were. That was a much bigger deal.
Yeah. Okay.
So, would you like to move to role entrapment now? Because I think it's a fascinating follow-on from the boundary heightening. Yeah.
I think that in a way we almost discussed that already before.
We did many parts of it. Yeah, so many parts of it, right? So I will just to summarize for our listeners, and then you can decide if there's anything else you want to add. Okay. So Cantor talks about how the women get trapped in, or sorry, the tokens get trapped in roles. And so we talked about the status leveling where people get, assume a woman in the office is a secretary if all the other people are male. We talked about this thing I thought was just fascinating, the stereotypical role induction where the dominants basically have these lenses that I think Deborah talked about earlier that they put the women in. In this particular case, it was women, you know, the mother, seductress, and the pet and Iron Maiden, which I think we did discuss. And then she talks about the responses of the tokens to the role entrapment. And I think that's the only part of this that we didn't discuss. And I just, you know, if you have anything to mention about that, where they basically, they're talking about the time it takes and the difficulty that it takes for the people who are placed in these roles or inducted into the roles. To me, it's more like forced into the role, but I guess the language could be different. She talks in here that many times writes about the tokens think it's too much time and effort to try to go into a different role, so they just don't bother with it. So I have a question for you too, because I was a little fuzzy on this part of it. Okay. I wonder how you interpret this. So she talked about one of the big responses to the women to keep the risk lower to themselves was to distort upward communication. And she never really explains what she means by that, this distorting of the upward communication. So I'm curious how you interpreted that. I have my own idea, but I'm curious, how did you two see that? She mentions this on, I think it's on page 984, that's one of the responses, but she doesn't describe it. So it's a little kind of an ambiguous concept for me.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that reference. Because it's a reference to the work by another author.
Yeah, so I don't know, but it was just kind of a brief and fleeting thing. And I'm thinking, well, she's talking about the responses, so I thought, well, this must be pretty important. And then I was having troubles processing that. Peter, did you have an idea? Am I just catching if it's too difficult? Because I'm picking something small out that didn't seem as salient to you as me.
It didn't strike me, to be honest. I didn't even highlight that.
Okay.
But I am already excited to go on to the next, which is, I would say, the
implications.
The implications, the big things, exactly. Yes, thank you.
Yes, because we have lots of good stuff to talk about implications. And I would say Pedro and both Deborah have got plenty of stuff to talk about here. And it's going to be really interesting. So this is going to be fun.
I couldn't resist.
Right, so I'll start on one piece, right? So Cantor talks about, it's actually two pieces that are similar. She says, many studies and at this time, this is where Deborah is going to really help us, but many studies up until this time had looked at the differences in performance among men and women in these skewed work situations or work representations as a function of gender. And Cantor says, in light of what she identified in her study, that those things need to be reinterpreted, or those differences need to be reinterpreted. So I thought that part was fascinating. And then the other part that I thought was really interesting was she said, and we've talked quite a bit about around this, and I'll be curious to see your reactions. She said that, or wrote that, the merely just bringing women in, you know, and to say, okay, well, we're more diverse and we have women or tokens whichever would be your token, probably isn't sufficient because of these skewed differences that cause all these other difficulties. And that's very thoughtful. So I'm curious to your reactions about implications and other things you thought of.
I think this is one of my favorite parts of the paper. I mean, she's trying to put forward rereading of previous research. In a way, I think what she's going against here is this, I mean, I think she says that, and we said that in the beginning, is that these studies usually take the consequence for the cause, and it's beautiful social science, because she's trying to show that it's not about the traits or social forces or anything around that, but it's actually the dynamics that exist in the groups that make women behave in those ways. So it's not about being a woman,
right?
Which is the assumption, and is the, I would say, not gender appropriate assumption, because it's exactly starting with as face value that that is a something of significance, and there are specific ways of being a woman. She says, no, it's not about belonging to a category in the first place, but it's the way that the group dynamics are put forward and the options that are given to women that you can see those things playing
absolutely.
Out.
And
very strong.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the most fascinating things about this paper. That last section also made me think about the problem of adding women. Like, she talks about the problem of adding women as tokens, you know, adding one by one, and the problems that may cause in terms of this skewed representation, these skewed groups. But the problem of just simply adding women to an organization in general brings us back to this question of whether more fundamental changes need to happen with organizations, and the intimacy of what we might call feminine ways of behaving, whether it's, you know, more cooperative behavior or, and I say feminine with air quotes because they're not necessarily attached to women's bodies.
I think the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, that we still have today is the gender pay gap, which is, I think, one of the established things that, you know, gender theory and studies have brought forward, that, you know, even when you have, for instance, men in a female-dominated occupation, they still get paid more. Or even if you have women, you know, at higher numbers, the men still get paid more. So no matter the configuration puts it, no matter the number, there is something about the broader issues that has to do with power and status that the numbers won't resolve.
So that's a great example, or a great issue. And let me give you an example of that that's playing out right now in the United States. And it happened just before the Olympics. The U.S. Some members of the U.S. national football team, I'm going to use the European terminology, the women's team sued the U.S. Federation. We don't call it football in the Federation, but there you go. Because of the very large pay disparities between the male and the women players. And it's fascinating because that's very similar. You know, they're working similar hours, and you would say kicking a football around is about the same, no matter who's cooking, you know, kicking it. And the goal is to score the exact same way, right? The rules are all the same. And the women's point is, you know, we're fabulously successful. We have all these trophies and tournaments that we've won and international recognition. Mm-hmm. And the governing body, you know, they're taking a more they're taking a different view, and they're saying, well, the men's game gets higher numbers and more visibility and more people watch on television, you know, those kinds of things. So it's this. So mm-hmm. many times with the gender pay inequities, you don't find, you know, as clear cut examples of this where they're doing the exact same work and yet they're mm-hmm. paid far differently. So this is a really interesting case, and I'm not saying that I don't know how it's going to be resolved, but I just think it's a really good example of what you're talking about, Pedro, where these differences exist, and yet they're perpetuated for these reasons that have a lot to do with power and other issues, as opposed to, oh yeah, well, you know, that makes sense at this fundamental level, because I think you can't justify it that way. And I wanted to go back to something that Deborah said about this, the idea that more fundamental changes in the workplace versus just adding, you know, more tokens. I think it's a fascinating idea, because if you think about it, one of the things the dominant group is saying is, yes, we'll bring in tokens, but we're not changing the workplace, you know, because we have the power and we will decide how this is done. So the tokens just basically have to leave some of their characteristics or features or capabilities or something at the door to get through this door, to be part of this group or this structure or what have you. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, Peter, you were talking about the way women lead and this, you know, these assimilation pressures sort of drive out their differences. And so I wonder, have we really come all that far since, you know, Cantor? Because we still, there's still a lot of pressure to assimilate as opposed to, why don't we rethink the work design, right? Because Deborah was talking about the, oh yeah, and that's actually a very common defense of the pay gap, if I'm getting that correct now, this idea that women will take time off to raise families and, you know, men do not. And therefore, there's these natural, you know, pay disparities, as opposed to rethinking how people fit in the workplace and how they can contribute so they can do things like that. And that way, because I think it's unfair. This is my personal view. Maybe I'm not supposed to have a strong position. So I shouldn't say it that way. So I'll try to be a better social scientist.
No, it's okay.
Put a lot of pressure on women. we put a lot of pressure on women to give up these things that are important or that, you know, they value, because we say, well, you can't be part of this group. And so that would seem to be a very significant pressure that we just say, well, it's built into the nature of the work. So
I think these are really important points. Yeah. And I just wanted to mention that this also goes for people who aren't different in the sense that their bodies are different, that they're women, that they're ethnic minorities, that they... But also if you are part of a normally privileged group but don't fit the norm in particular ways.
I agree. And in fact, I've thought that several times over my career that I would like to have more options, because my wife, she did take off working and adjust her career for children. And not only was I very grateful for that, but I noticed, well, you know, here I'm in this privileged position where I'm not being asked to do that. And I also thought though, she's going to have a relationship with our children that I can't have because of the fact that she's able to be this stay-at-home parent or devote more of the time to parenting. And I actually felt that was a loss for me, that I'm not sure all the things I was able to accomplish at work outweigh those other features, and I felt like that was a limitation on me.
Yeah. I just want to take this and, you know, put an Olympic spin here, because I was in the Olympics like
our Olympic episode.
Yeah.
Yes.
So first thing, I think what you Ralph and Deb said, it's about the challenge of opening the category or opening the box. It's not only about exactly the point of assimilating and creating specific roles, whatever that may be, that's more feminine or masculine, whatever, but actually rethinking or redesigning, as you said.
Yes.
And yes. And I was thinking to myself, you know, that today we have the Olympics and the Paralympics, you know, and you can become an Olympic athlete or a Paralympic athlete, you know, and that bothers me utterly, to be honest, you know, because that creates exactly, I mean, for me, the real challenge, you know, would be the one of integrating, of opening the definition of what does it be to be an athlete. And so since people don't do that, they just create like the separate, I would say, box that you can compete and win and you are sidetracked, you know. My second Olympic example, you know, to keep on this reason that you both brought forward on the consequences of sexism for both genders, or even more, you know, not necessarily there are two, but, you know, for multiple sides, not only for a woman. I recently came across a piece that was talking about male gymnasts and how there was this whole discussion on whether they, I think, actually some of them were pushing to compete with more, I would say, sexy or, you know, revealing clothing, because they felt that because they felt that these uniforms, let's put it, they felt that this way they would get more media attention and then more money and more, you know, support and so on and so forth. So it creates exactly the example of how sexism in general, and, you know, certainly of sexism, ends up, you know, might create consequences for all different kinds of genders.
Right. So the other example I was thinking from the Olympics, because I think there are several ways that you can see that these kinds of things coming up in the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
There was somebody was asking the athletes who were in, there are some Olympic sports where there really isn't a strong reason for having them be segregated, but they still are. And the one that comes to mind immediately is synchronized swimming.
Oh, yeah.
And somebody was asking the synchronized swimmers so right now that's only women. Only women can compete in synchronized swimming. And so somebody was asking, well, should we integrate the teams? And so an interesting question. So I not only did I think it was an interesting question, I didn't even realize things like synchronized swimming, where I would be hard pressed to say, you know, there should be any differences, that I didn't even know men weren't allowed to compete. So I didn't even think about it. So I just thought it was interesting that it came up.
So I think I want to bring another spin to the issue of implications, which is, what about the, I would say, minorities that cannot or rarely could be raised to be a majority in the workplace? I think about sexual minorities, but you can think about religious groups and, you know, all kinds of different categories that it's hard to expect that to be like a 50-50 situation in companies and organizations in general. So what does we have to say to that? It's another issue that I feel that this kind of design that puts all about numbers falls short.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really interesting point, Pedro. And it's something that came up, not explicitly, but came up in the research that I was doing with diversity practitioners and in their training. And in training now, the approach that's being used is kind of what Ralph was talking about earlier, I think, training to treat people as individuals, as opposed to the social group approach. Mm. And there are problems to do with the individualization of diversity, but I think on this particular point, it's an advantage to do things in that way. As you say, because having proportionate representation of certain groups is statistically unlikely in some cases.
There is one thing that I want to say to respond to this issue of individualization is that I don't know how it was that, you know, scripted or taught, but I wonder that we must recognize in a way that there are sometimes specific things or more common things that specific categories face, you know, maybe just because the way the current expectations are, you know, I would say that, for instance, the more typical prejudices that a person might face from one specific category, you know, being a man or being a handicapped person or being gay or being from a racial minority. So I wonder that, yes, I agree fully that it's treating as individual is really important. But also I wonder that, you know, it's important to create, to nurture sensitivity to challenges that might be more common on several categories. I don't know how they resolve that.
What Pedro is talking about is one of the problems that I alluded to when I was making that statement about one of the benefits of training people to treat others as individuals, mm-hmm. is that doing that solely can kind of erase histories of patterns of inequality, and that certain people, certain groups of people in our social context have persistently been at a disadvantage. And that's incredibly important to remember and to recognize in order to rectify.
Well, and that's what I was thinking when Peter was talking about these particular kinds of groups where it could never become, just for some, you know, particular reasons, may never become the dominant. So maybe I shouldn't say could never, but may never become a dominance. Mm-hmm. That's why I think there's great value in this kind of research, is to make it clear what these pressures and difficulties are at when you treat people like they're just categories, right? And fairly narrow categories at that. You know, because I think there's no one way you can go address that. So that's why I love Deborah's observation about this less group-focused training or category-based training as opposed to more individualistic. I mean, it may have limitations, but I think that's one of the lessons or implications that I draw from Cantor's research, is that's still healthy to do, is recognize that these things and challenges and social pressures exist.
Yeah, I think I'm going to follow your concluding lines. And I just want to say that I think one of the things that I really take from the text, I think, is usually the historical value, because, you know, in a way I always felt in a TV show about, you know, women in the 70s and the workplace and how these dynamics started to emerge as women entered these industrial organizations. And I really appreciate the ability that she had to, in a way, reinterpret previous research and push her understanding towards looking at the structural aspects that create specific kind of dynamics between genders instead of just assuming that what we are observing comes from the fact there is a difference in gender in the first place. And I think, I mean, although it creates problem, this whole idea of tokenism, as we said, I think it has been very important, specifically that at that time, to show that, you know, just this piecemeal policy was not going to be enough. You know, she had a whole idea about equality in numbers, and of course we, in a way, deconstructed that in our discussion. But I think it was very important back then because, in a way, it was probably very revolutionary to say, you know, it's not just about having some woman there. This won't cut, you know. So, yeah. So some admiration for all this, you know, important work.
Absolutely. Picking up on that point, Pedro, I think how I've heard what you're saying is that what she was doing was quite revolutionary, you know, when she was writing it and opening doors to new mm-hmm. discussions. And we might think about that, you know, the doors that are open now and the discussions that we're having now that lead on from where Cantor left off, where she's talking about rectifying the balance of gender, or, you know, achieving balanced groups as an alternative strategy to skewed groups or having token women. And that we're now in a place where we're discussing the implications of trying to do that, for example, through quotas for women on corporate boards, which have been implemented in some European countries, and, you know, some backlash that's gone on around the idea of that in others. For in the UK, we have a voluntarist system at the moment. We don't have a compulsory quota, whereas in Norway, for example, is the most famous case being the first, they have a 40% quota. And so we're now dealing with the dynamics of how that might play out and the difficulties that we might face.
I think one of the great benefits that both of you were talking about, we're talking about maybe work redesign, opening categories, and then Deborah was talking about the research has gone from this groundbreaking study that Cantor did, is that it gives us this, and then I think it also shows the power of social science research mm-hmm. in that it gives us a better vocabulary and richer understanding of these differences that we see and challenges us to see them differently, these things that we had taken for granted. And that's one of the things I took away from the research that Cantor did. And I'm very glad that Deborah suggested it. I really thought it was very important for me to see these perspectives that I wouldn't have seen without reading the article. And that's why I recommend our readers, mm-hmm. Make sure you read the article. There's a lot of good stuff in there.
I'd just like to say thank you for having me join in with your discussion today. It's been really interesting. And I'm really glad to see gender featured. Perhaps you'll have more episodes there that relate to kind of gender or other forms of difference as you go along.
Yes, thank you, Deborah. It was good to have
you. We hope so, and thank you for being here with us.
And that concludes episode 17. Thank you for listening. As always, if you find these discussions of value, please share them with your friends, colleagues, and students. You can also leave us some positive comments on iTunes or elsewhere. These really help new listeners find us. Thank you, and we hope you check in next week as we release a summary of Token Women here on Talking About Organizations.